Township of Eureka. Happy to be here with you all and sitting next to my colleague, Senator Fateh. If you've been following the news, you've seen some interesting changes or approaches to the legislature this session. One of those changes is that, at least for the time being, Republicans and Democrats in the Senate are going to be co-chairing committees. And so as strange as it is for me to kick things off, my thanks to my colleague, Senator Fateh, for meeting with us ahead of time to talk about how we would handle this committee as a partnership and how we would handle things moving forward. So that means I'm going to, unfortunately for all of you, kind of be running the show today. We'll have the next go-around, and we're going to alternate as we try to do good work for the people of Minnesota. And I'm hopeful that our bipartisan approach and start to this session here in the Senate will lead to good things to come and is a sign of what folks can expect in terms of the work we're going to do on behalf of the people of Minnesota. So with that being said, we'd like to welcome you to give any opening remarks as well, if you'd like to.
I'll keep it brief. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And good to see all of you members and staff in the committee. I want to say thank you to Mr. Fossum and Chair Duckworth for meeting with us ahead of time to talk about what this committee will look like and committee structure. We're going to have a good year. It's going to be fun. And looking forward to hearing from OHI as well. So thank you.
All right. Thanks very much. Before we begin, I want to do just a couple of quick introductions for folks. We've got some new staff here with us. We've got a couple of new members to the committee. I know they had to fight tooth and nail to get on this committee, so we want to give them a chance to introduce themselves as well. And if it's all right, we're going to start with our counsel, Mr. Watson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hello, Senators. My name is Tom Watson with the council's office, covering higher ed, so reach out to me if you need any bills or legal research. Excited to be part of the committee.
Thank you, sir. Next, our fiscal analyst, Megan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Megan Birch, fiscal analyst for higher ed. And likewise, if you have any fiscal-related questions, please reach out.
Sounds good. I promise not to put you guys on the spot any more than we need to, so I appreciate it. Next, our committee administrators. We'll start with you, Sam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sam Parmakar, committee administrator for the DFL caucus, and Senator Fateh.
Jason Fossum, I'm the temporary committee administrator on the Republican side for Senator Duckworth.
I know what many of you are thinking, and I did not draw the short straw to get Mr. Fossum. Just kidding. I also do want to thank our legislative assistants, Chris Meyer and Joshua Duran, for helping out as well. And then last but not least, we'll go ahead and let our senators introduce themselves. We'll start with Senator Farnsworth and work our way this way.
I'm Rob Farnsworth, state senator for District 7, which includes most of the Iron Range, about half of Itasca County and about half of Aiken County.
Senator Rob Kupek, I have Senate District 4, which is most of Clay County and large chunk of Becker. I go from about Moorhead over to Detroit Lakes, and I'll hand it to my neighbor to the east.
Thank you. Yes, I'm Paul Lutke. I represent Senate District 5, which is just directly, we border, share an east-west border there. In west central Minnesota, I represent all or parts of six counties from Becker to Hubbard, Cass, Todd, Wadena, and some of Morrison. So thank you. I'm here to learn a lot. It's my first time in higher ed.
So we're certainly glad to have you. Thank you. Are you good? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Claire Umu-Verbaden. I represent District 66 in the Minnesota Senate. So that includes parts of St. Paul, Roseville, Falcon Heights, and Lauderdale. Glad to be back.
Jason Rarick, I represent District 11, which is all of Pine and Carlton counties, half of Kennebec, and a little bit of St. Louis and Chisago. And everybody else missed, but that must mean I have the two best higher education schools in my district, in Fond du Lac Tribal and Community College and Pine Technical and Community College.
Very good. And then we'll see if Senator Putnam shows up. Senator Fateh told me to call him out since he's late. If he gets here, we'll give him a chance to introduce himself. I'm sure he will anyway. So with that being said, we're going to go ahead and get things started. traditionally, we start things off each session with the commissioner and an agency overview, so I'd like to invite you forward, sir. Go ahead and begin your presentation, and we're very happy to welcome you and anybody who is here with you to the committee. Thanks for being here. We appreciate it.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Dennis Olson. I'm proud to serve as the commissioner of the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. And yeah, just first and foremost, appreciate the opportunity to start committee here with an overview of the agency of the Office of Higher Education, especially for new members and maybe as a refresher for returning members as well. I have with me quite a few leaders from the agency. We're going to kind of popcorn in and out as we cover some of the slides from the overview, and then look forward to on Thursday as well, following up on a little bit deeper dive on the Minnesota State Grant Program in particular. So we're just going to touch upon it here today, but just as a maybe a precursor, if there are any in-depth questions about state grant, we do have agency leaders and experts here that can certainly answer them now, but maybe answered on Thursday and more appropriately. So wanted to start just by talking a little bit about some of our responsibilities within the agency. Some of you who are familiar with the responsibilities as well as our administration and oversight of programs will be familiar with some of these, but our primary responsibility in the state is to administer our state financial aid programs. And those listed for you on the screen there are, of course, the Minnesota State Grant, which I just mentioned, kind of our largest and key financial aid program, state financial aid program, but also the Minnesota State Work Study Program, Minnesota Child Care Grants, the Minnesota Indian Scholarship Program, which is our oldest financial aid program that we administer. And we also negotiate tuition reciprocity agreements with neighboring states, as well as administer the Minnesota self-loan. We also administer quite a few different competitive and legislatively named grants, and we're going to go through those in detail with you as well in terms of appropriation amounts and a little bit of related data from the most recent fiscal years as data is available. We also have oversights for registration and licensing of degree-granting colleges, as well as respectively non-degree-granting career schools through our licensing and registration division. I mentioned that we do negotiate and administer those tuition reciprocity agreements with neighboring states. We also administer federally funded programs, namely the Get Ready program, which is funded through the federal Gear Up funds. And you'll hear a little bit more information about that, some exciting news, recent news as well. We collect, of course, and maintain and report data on students in post-secondary institutions, a robust research division within the agency. That, of course, produces reports both that are legislatively mandated as well as other reports and fulfilled data requests from members of the public or on behalf of our public and private institutions as well. Of course, we offer plenty of technical assistance. I just kind of mentioned one of the ways we do that and a lot of training as well around the intersection of campus sexual misconduct policy and Title IX. When I read that first, I said, What is TICS? That's Title IX, actually, an abbreviation of Title IX. Of course, research and report on the effectiveness of post-secondary institutions and produce reports annually around post-secondary attainment. And before I get into the attainment conversation, just want to give you a little bit of a funding profile of the agency. You'll see that our largest slice of the pie there is general fund funding from appropriated from the state legislature. That's about 76% of our total agency funding. And then just the pullout box there tells you that almost all of that general fund funding appropriations from the state do go directly out to students either in the form of financial aid or are passed on to student serving organizations or other organizations through legislatively mandated grants. So just a hair of our general fund budget actually goes to overall agency administration and supports the agency. Also, the green box there represents non-state funds. Those would be primarily self-funded functions of our agency, like the licensing and registration division that I had mentioned, self-sustaining through fee revenue, as well as the Minnesota self-loan, which is also self-funded, not funded through state appropriations, and then the sliver of federal funds there, primarily the GEAR Up funding. So I wanted to walk through briefly kind of our most recent data around Minnesota's educational attainment goal. Some of you may be intimately familiar with this. We've shared kind of our progress throughout the years. You may remember, though, that the state set a 10-year educational attainment goal back in 2015, and the citation is there. And the goal in 2015 was an aspirational one, said by the year 2025, the legislature would like 70% of Minnesota adults aged 25 to 44 to attain some sort of post-secondary credential beyond high school. And so that, of course, includes certificates and diplomas, associate's degrees, bachelor's degrees, and graduate degrees, as well as professional degrees. The goal within the language also had a 70% benchmark for all race and ethnicity groups. So Minnesota's goal actually is one of the few in the nation that actually had that specific call for disaggregated data and set benchmarks of 30 and 50% as well. Ultimately, the goal of the legislature was to meet the goal overall, but also to meet the goal equitably. We're currently at about 63.3% attainment right now. We kind of wrestle with the state of Massachusetts and Colorado for, you know, one of the highest attainment rates in the nation. And so, you know, we started from a pretty high place of overall higher educational attainment, and have continued to make incremental progress. You can see with at least an associate's degree, about 57% there, and those with certificates, about 6.5%. So this is what the goal calls for, is again, tracking all race categories. And you can see we've made incremental progress in attainment throughout the last 9 or so years that we have data that we've been able to track. But those gaps still persist. You know, if you're familiar with conversations within the E12 space, you know, we talk about the graduation gaps and, you know, really the gaps by race and ethnicity, and you can see those represented here. So again, you know, overall, we are at that 63, almost 64% as a state, but some significant gaps exist. Here you can see that, you know, really overall, I think the lead of the story here on this slide is that in order to meet our educational attainment goal, you know, we need an additional 101,000, almost 102,000 additional credentials to be earned by Minnesotans to hit that 70%. And you can see, again, it disaggregated by race. You can tell the proportional numbers there on the slide. Of numbers of credentials that would need to be attained to meet the goal, again, not only overall, but equitably as well. This is another representation of that slide, however, shown a little bit differently in terms of the numbers of, or the percentage of folks that have attained either a degree or those that are at the certificate level. And a lot of progress has been made here as well. There were some racial groups that had primarily or, you know, close to kind of a 50% certificate attainment and a 50% degree attainment. And so those gaps have seemed to shorten a little bit with, you know, more folks attaining degrees rather than certificates or returning to, you know, continue to upskill or reskill there. I talked about disaggregated data. One of the really important things I like to point out is that, you know, although we don't although we have the ability to track by race, we also have the ability to disaggregate further by ethnicity. And this is, again, another one of the unique opportunities we have in tracking our data within the statewide attainment goal, is that we're able to look a little deeper within large race categories. And so you can see there the difference in ethnic categories within a larger race category, and some of the disproportionate numbers there that may be masked when you look at kind of a larger race category. You know, it helps not only us pinpoint, you know, our research and investment recommendations a little bit, but hopefully also helps members of the legislature, you know, kind of consider some specific recommendations and investments that may be needed by a particular community within a larger race category. And this again, next slide kind of represents that same conversation there again within within the race categories.
Commissioner, if I may, I'm just ask you a quick follow-up question on that. Is this all information that's kind of self-identified via various applications that students fill out as they're looking at financial aid or they're applying to certain schools, or how is it that you're coming about this pretty detailed information?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, there's a combination of, I guess, ways that this is tracked. The educational attainment data is actually a combination of data that we have from data reported to us by the institutions. We also utilize data available to us in the statewide longitudinal educational data system, SLEDS, as well as data that's provided by the Census Bureau. And so we use American Community Survey data, ACS data, and you know, some of these are estimates, particularly around the certificate data, because it's, you know, it's a combination of data factors, and so it's pulled primarily from one of those one of those data contributors. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So
we got one more question for you. Senator Fatte, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. I'm looking at some of the educational attainment data as well, looking at where we're at relative to the 70% attainment goal. And I'm just wondering if there's also any information around those specific students, how many of them that completed either a two-year or four-year degree went on to get obtain a job within their field within a certain amount of time upon completion of their degree. If so, do we also have that data broken down by race also? And also, if it's more of a DEED thing, is there any communication with DEED around that also?
Commissioner.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Fatte. It's a great question and, you know, probably a little complicated for my ability to answer. However, yeah, I will say that that data is available primarily through our longitudinal data system, which really you know, tracks education and workforce outcomes, birth through workforce. You know, so we're able to look at employment outcomes, you know, at a particular point in time. I will say that the data represented here in the attainment data is the highest credential attained. And so it's not, you know, duplicate data if someone has a two-year degree and then has gone on to, you know, complete a four-year degree or beyond. It'll track their highest level of data. I'll also say there is a new, or not necessarily new anymore, but an opportunity for Minnesota as well as other states to collaborate with the Census Bureau to incorporate what they're calling PSEO data, which is, I wanna say post-secondary enrollment options. It's not that PSEO. It is, it's post-secondary employment outcomes data. And there are ways now where they're, you know, collaborating with state data systems to show, you know, whether it be graduate outcomes at a year out, at 5 years out, at 10 years out, you know, if folks have changed occupations, if they have moved to other states and come back, all of that is kind of new opportunity that we're incorporating into not only the attainment conversation, but into our longitudinal data system as well.
Thank you, Commissioner. And now that I've noticed Senator Putnam is with us, we're going to start over all the way back to your first slide. Just kidding. He's got a question for you as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for recognizing me and for recognizing my tardiness. And thank you, Commissioner, for all this information. It's impressive. And I'll say sobering and motivating rather than depressing and frustrating. It's good to know where we're at in order to know where we need to go. But I did have another question about the data that we've got here. Do you track socioeconomic class at all? Obviously, one of the functions of higher education is for social mobility. Do we have any sense of how these sort of attainment goals would shake down in terms of socioeconomic class as well?
Yeah.
I'll take a crack at that if it's okay. For the record, my name is,
Might need you to get a little bit closer if you can there.
Hello. For the record, my name is Wendy Robinson. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Programs, Policies, and Grants here at the Office of Higher Education. And I will say we're kind of looking at each other and saying kind of, because we do have the ability to track data by things like Pell eligibility, by free and reduced lunch status, some of those things. We have not used that as a particular marker when we've looked at our attainment data in terms of disaggregating along those population lines, because that wasn't, I think, how the original attainment goal was set. But could we pull that data and look at kind of what the outcomes are along things like Pell eligibility, state grant eligibility, some of those other factors that are a proxy for socioeconomic status? Yes, we could.
Any follow-up? Okay. Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And welcome, Senator Putnam. Appreciate the stumper there right after arriving. So you probably can notice I have a little bit of a frog in my throat. Thankfully, this is my last slide, but wanted to potentially tee up a future conversation with the committee here. I mentioned that this goal was set by the legislature in 2015. It was a 10-year goal. Do the math. We are in 2025 right now. There's nothing in the language that specifies a specific month, or rather even, whether it be a fiscal year, a legislative calendar year, a traditional calendar year, or a data year, or a school year, or what. So, you know, we recognize that 2025 is in front of us right now, and hopefully this would be an opportunity for a conversation with the committee on potentially, re-upping the goal, reestablishing a new goal, tweaking the language. We'd like to invite the committee for some feedback on, what the next educational attainment goal 2.0 is. For the state, I will just mention that this effort was really spurred by efforts from the Lumina Foundation at the national level. They report every year, although utilizing a little bit of different data metrics. They track adults, the age range a little bit differently, go up to age 65, but they report an annually called Stronger Nation. And the Lumina Foundation as well has recognized that a lot of these goals were set in 2015. A lot of states are coming up on that 10-year mark. All but one state within the nation have an educational attainment goal, and so they're facing similar conversations with their legislative bodies and other higher ed leaders as well. So just wanted to, make sure that the committee was aware that's an opportunity here, and certainly on behalf of the Office of Higher Education, we're interested in conversations to potentially further that goal or meet the state's needs at this point in time. So with that, I will turn it over to Dr. Robinson here and allow you to take the arrows for the next group of slides, and of course we'll stick around for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. As Commissioner Olson shared, we know that we'll be doing a deeper dive into state grant in a future hearing, but we thought it might be helpful to start with kind of the higher level overview of our state financial aid programs and the mechanisms by which our students access those state financial aid programs. So the first one that we'll talk about is the Free Application for Federal Student Aid, or the FAFSA, and the Minnesota DREAM Act application. The story of FAFSA last year was kind of a good news, bad news story. So if you happen to have known any high school seniors or parents or anybody who worked at a high school or at a college financial aid office, you know they were stressed out last year. I've been working in higher education for over 20 years. Last year was by far the hardest and most challenging year for accessing financial aid that I've ever seen and that I hope, frankly, to ever see again. We knew kind of going into the year that it might be a little bit challenging. I think it exceeded anybody's expectations for level of challenge in terms of the ability for students and their parents to access the form in a timely fashion, to be able to get their questions answered, to be able to get to that FAFSA completion target that we like to set. It was really a once-in-a-generation experience based on some technical and computer changes that came from the Department of Education. So that was the bad news. We knew that it was really a challenging year for people to access that. The good news is that through a combination of a lot of collaboration, a lot of messaging, a lot of outreach, Minnesota actually ended up in positive territory by the start of the fall semester in terms of the percentage of our students who had completed FAFSA. And so I think that was kind of somewhat surprising based on where the number had tracked for most of the year. But we had really done some collaborative work with College Possible, with Achieve Twin Cities, with ECMC to try to provide additional support to students and their parents as they were navigating through their FAFSA experience. And where we ended up this year, and it's important to note also that the FAFSA is the form that the vast, vast majority of Minnesotans use to access our state financial aid programs. With the exception of the Minnesota Dream Act, we don't have a separate financial aid application. And so we knew that getting students to complete FAFSA was really important because we want them to be able to access our state financial aid opportunities. As of the start of this academic year, we actually were up 11% compared to the previous years. With the exception of we were still down a little bit in terms of incoming freshmen, that percentage, they were down about 5% in 2024 compared to 2023. The good news about that is that we are actually better than almost every other state in the country on that measure. So the overall national rate of FAFSA completion for that population of students was down almost 10%. And Minnesota was one of the top five states in the country in terms of closing the gap from the previous year for that population of students. And I think there's a variety of factors that led into our ability to close that gap and to be in those positive numbers this year, but it really took a lot of collaboration and a lot of strong messaging and support, especially from our campus financial aid partners as well.
Quick follow-up for you, if that's okay.
Yeah.
So thanks, that's helpful information. Up 11% from the previous year. Do you recall what the overall percentage is for completion?
I don't have that. Chair, I don't have that number handy, but we can find that for you.
Okay, sounds good. Thank you.
So next, we'd like to talk about the other form that students can use to access our state financial aid programs, and that's the Minnesota Dream Act application. And that was established by the legislature in 2013, and it was designed with the intent to ensure that Minnesotans who are residents who are not eligible to apply for the FAFSA through the FAFSA application have an opportunity to access our state financial aid programs. Minnesota residents who may apply for state aid via that act versus FAFSA can include students in a variety of situations, including those who have some different visa situations. They may be still pending for asylum. They may be here through DACA. They do have to still, again, meet the residency requirements and be able to go through that process. In my next slide, we'll talk a little bit about the numbers so you can kind of see the percentage of Minnesotans who are accessing state financial aid through the DREAM Act versus through the FAFSA. So comparing for fiscal year 23 and 24, you can see that the percentage of students who access state grant and North Star Promise through the DREAM Act is incredibly small. For the fiscal year 23, it was less than 1% of our students who are accessing state grant came through the Minnesota DREAM Act application. And for fiscal year 24, 506 students were awarded the state grant through the DREAM Act application, which represented, again, less than 1% of the total students funded. For the students who accessed North Star Promise through the DREAM Act application, it was 0.03%, or about 150 students. So again, when we say the vast majority of students are doing the federal financial aid application, we really mean the vast majority of students are doing that application instead. And next, I'll turn it over to Megan Flores from our financial aid department to walk us through some of our other state financial aid programs, unless there are any questions.
This will reach if you want to sleep.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Megan Flores, and I serve as the manager of our state financial aid programs. Today, we're going to walk through those various financial aid programs, and I'm happy to answer any questions as you have them.
I have one to begin. Are you going to be the person that comes back on Thursday to talk more state grant stuff, or is that going to be somebody else?
I will, along with my colleague, Nicole Whaley.
Okay, sounds good. Thank you.
Yep. So the first program we'll start talking about is the Minnesota State Grant, which, as you heard, is our largest state financial aid program. This is a need-based program and in many ways is the state's version of the federal Pell Grant, which is the primary need-based program at the federal level. This program was established in 1969. It's for Minnesota residents who are pursuing undergraduate degrees at our public as well as our private post-secondary institutions. Those institutions have to be in the state of Minnesota, so our state grant program is not transportable to other states outside of Minnesota. Our most recent year, the academic year 23-24, which would be fiscal year 24, we had 71,530 recipients receiving funding from the program. Two-thirds of those recipients are dependent students, dependent in regards to the way the FAFSA and the Minnesota DREAM Act application measures students, not to be confused with the tax forms and who's dependent or independent. We have over 75 institutions that participate in our state grant program, and our annual budget is $225 million. The average award is approximately $3,400 per student, and half of the recipients have a family-adjusted gross income of less than $40,000. Most of our recipients are attending the public institutions in our state. You can see we've got almost 60% at Minnesota State 2- or 4-year institutions and about 17% at the U of M.
Senator Fatte, go ahead.
Yes, thank you so much. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see a part that says two-thirds of the recipients are dependent students, and I've seen some previous data also around this. I wanted to ask how many of the recipients are independents with dependents, or how many are student parents?
Thank you very much, Chair Pate. I don't know the answer to that question off the top of my head, but we can make sure to incorporate that into our presentation on Thursday, or we can get that information to you.
Thank you.
Got one more for you, Senator Kupick.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious, on the 59% at the Minnesota State Colleges, 17% at the University of Minnesota, how does that break down in the dollar percentage, though? What percentage of the state grants are at those two institutions, and what percentage are at private institutions?
Thank you, Senator Kupick. We will have that breakdown in our Thursday presentation. So we're going to have a lot of detail on numbers and graphs and all kinds of fun charts on Thursday. So today we're just going to do a little bit more of an overview. But do please feel free to ask those questions, because if we'll take that down. If we don't have it in our presentation, we'll make sure we incorporate that.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So the next program we'll talk about is the North Star Promise Program. As you know, this is a new program that came out of this body in the 2023 legislative session. Oftentimes you'll hear us talk about the program in two different program types. So for example, you'll hear us refer to as North Star Promise Base and another word called the North Star Promise Plus. So we'll break that down a little bit for you today. The total appropriation for that program for the first fiscal year of the program, 2025, is $112 million and approximately almost $49.5 million ongoing in the base starting with FY26. The North Star Promise program is a last dollar program that covers tuition and fees. It's available to Minnesota residents who attend a public college in the state and have an adjusted gross income from their prior year tax forms, which is what the FAFSA uses, of less than $80,000 a year. The North Star Promise Plus, so the second part of the program, it's an additional award for eligible students who have the greatest financial needs. So these are students who are in that Pell Grant eligibility criteria. The number of recipients and the average awards you can see there, this is for the current fall term that just ended. We had about 14,500 students who received awards under that base award program, or about 1820, was the average award. For the PLUS, the secondary program, North Star Promise PLUS, we had about 40,000 students receiving that, and the average award was $376. When you kind of break down that overlap of who was receiving or qualified for both the North Star Promise base as well as the PLUS award, there were about 5,700 students who received both of those.
I've got a follow-up for you, if that's okay.
Of course.
So I don't recall everything from the last two sessions, but I do recall some things. And so could you help me remember how we have both the North Star Promise and the North Star Plus? Because I certainly remember the North Star, but what's the plus, or how did that come about, or where was that sort of in the legislation that was passed, or how was the office looking at that and treating those students a little bit differently?
Thank you, Chair Duckworth. Senators, I can speak to that. So the North Star Promise Plus was the base award, as I mentioned. The North Star Promise Plus is a supplemental grant that is meant to help the highest needs students with costs that go beyond tuition and fees. So this would be something like for the very neediest students to get a little bit of help paying for books, supplies, transportation, those basic living expense needs that we hear so much about from our students. As you can see, the average award is about $376. So on the per student basis, these are not large awards, but definitely are helping these students who are the very neediest among our Minnesota residents.
Thank you.
That program is temporary, written into the statutory language for 3 years.
Okay, so the PLUS program, as of right now, is in existence for 3 years unless it's continued. Did I understand that correctly?
Senator Duckworth, that's correct. Okay. As funds are available.
Okay.
And it's a percentage up to 50% of the Pell Grant amount.
Gotcha. So the awards for students that would qualify for the PLUS program, is that simply based on the same sort of financial metrics, or are there other things being used and taken into consideration to award them some of these additional dollars?
Thank you, Chair Duckworth. Yep, the North Star Promise Plus amount is this year 15% of a student's Pell Grant award. And so the federal government sets that federal Pell Grant award, and the financial aid administrators on the campuses participating in the program will look at the student's Pell Grant program award amount, and then they will award 15% of that for this current 24-25 academic year.
Thank you. I've got one more for you, but I'm going to go to Senator Rarick first. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as we look at the numbers, you said 5,700 students achieved both. So that would say we have 3,500 students in the North Star Promise Plus. That's the only monies that they received from the North Star Promise. Did they receive, through Pell and all the other things, kind of free tuition, or why do we see such a disparity in the numbers between the two programs?
Thank you, Senator Rarick. I believe you meant to state 35,000 students, not 3,500, but I followed you. You're correct. For the North Star Promise Plus, to qualify, they still have to meet that, have less than an 80,000 adjusted gross income and all the other criteria of the base program. And you are correct that those other students, they did not have tuition and fees that were uncovered by grants or scholarships, but they were still receiving a Pell Grant. And so they fell into that category where those other forms of financial aid were covering the tuition and fees, so they did not receive the base award.
Any follow-up? Okay. So just one more question for you, and this is higher level, because I know we're going to talk more state grant stuff Thursday. But oftentimes in the legislature, we look at different pools of money or pools of funding. We've got pools of funding for the state grant. We've got a pool of funding for the North Star Promise. Is there any relation between the two pools? Meaning, does one program or has one program affected or impacted the other in terms of financial aid or dollars that are being awarded to students?
Chair Duckworth, thank you for the question. So to answer your question, we have appropriated funds that are designated per each program. So there isn't an overlap in that way, if I understand your question, but there are students who qualify for both programs. As my colleague, Dr. Robinson, mentioned, we have seen an 11% increase in FAFSA filers. And as you've heard us mention previously, enrollment is up. So we do have an increased number of students in the pool, an increased number of qualified students in the pool. I should say. And so definitely we're having the resources spread among more eligible students who are enrolling. And in the nature of the North Star Promise program, since it is a last dollar program, when we have additional state grant recipients who are eligible, that can impact definitely that North Star Promise award. Likewise, if we saw, for example, cuts to the federal Pell Grant or other aid programs, since we are looking at that total amount of scholarships and grants to the student, if any of those funding sources changed, it would be possible for that to impact both this, the North Star Promise program especially.
And as we look at that program, being that it's newer and we're kind of, you know, seeing how it plays out the first year or two, I'm curious, in terms of some of the funding that was set aside or designated for that program, or even the state grant program for that matter, did we find that there were any funds remaining or left over, or were all the funds set aside for those programs exhausted by those that applied for them?
Chair, that's an excellent question. We will dig into that a little bit deeper, but we definitely are experiencing some strain on the financial aid programs because of the high level of enrollment that we're experiencing, which is a good thing, right? This is what we wanted, just to piggyback on Commissioner Olson's work on the attainment goals. We need, I think it was another 101,000 folks from Minnesota to get a credential by the end of 2025. So I think by my count, we've got 12 months, right? So I'm hopeful, but we shall see, right? But yes, definitely we're seeing a strain on those programs where these budgets are strained because of high enrollment. And specifically, we'll get into more details Thursday, but the types of students that we're matriculating in our state. Mm-hmm.
So the last question I have for you, it's really probably more feedback than anything, would be as you're looking at this information more carefully and we're asking you questions and you're trying to help us figure out what we can or can't do or should plan for in the future, it would be this. If we've designated funding for certain types of programs and it's not fully being exhausted, are we in the laws that we create providing you all or whoever powers that be that are implementing these programs enough flexibility to, when it makes sense, go into one pool of funding that's been set aside that might still have dollars remaining in it and use that to offset or plus up another pool that's empty but that still has kids looking for tuition dollars? Again, not asking you to mm-hmm. It's not a question. It's just mostly a recommendation of how we can work together, your office and us as lawmakers, to say, hey, how do we make sure that we never find ourselves in a situation or a student or family doesn't find themselves in a situation where they could qualify for more funding that's available. It's just sitting in a different pool being mm-hmm. unused. That's kind of what I'm getting at. And so hopefully those are more conversations we can have in the future. Sorry to interrupt you. Please keep going.
Thank you, Senators, for the great questions. We're taking lots of notes. I see Commissioner Olson over here frantically writing. The next program we'll talk about is another program that's been very important to this committee in the past, and that's the Fostering Independence Higher Education Grant Program. I think we're in our third year of this program. This is a last dollar cost of attendance program for eligible Minnesotans who have experienced the foster care system in our state. It's available to Minnesotans who are under the age of 27 and were in foster care at any point after their 13th birthday. And this grant may cover up to the cost, or actually does cover the cost of attendance at any eligible Minnesota public or participating private college and university. The total appropriation is $3.75 million per year, and we did have an additional $5 million shifted from the North Star Promise program in 2024 to help fund an anticipated need in this program. We have awarded 492 students that very first year of the program, and then we awarded 679 students the second year of the program. I did take a peek preparing for today, and we do have 578 students enrolled under the program this fall. So we're trying to still see, with this program still being somewhat young, where it will kind of land when it plateaus. The next program I'd like to talk about is the American Indian Scholars Program. This actually is not a financial aid program, and it's not administered by OHE, but we wanted to be ensure to be sure to include this for you. It is administered at the campus level. It is a first dollar program that covers tuition and fees for eligible Minnesotans. And those are students who are enrolled members or citizens of any federally recognized or Canadian First Nation. A federally recognized tribe or Canadian First Nation. It's only available to students who are attending our public colleges and universities. So this would be Minnesota State and the U of M campuses. The data for the first year of the program we're still learning about from our campus partners. However, some of the self-reported data we do have for them is we have about 400 students receiving this benefit at Minnesota State and about 207 at the U of M. Another kind of related program is the Minnesota Indian Scholarship Program. This is our state's very first state financial aid program, and it provides assistance to eligible Minnesotans who are enrolled members or citizens of a federally recognized American Indian tribe or Canadian First Nation who are a quarter or more of American Indian ancestry. The grant can be awarded based on $4,000 per year, up to $4,000 per year for an undergrad, and up to $6,000 for graduate students. We do typically see anywhere between 800 to 1,000 students in this program. You can see, you know, we had 829 in FY23 and 974 FY24. We're looking at a very similar number to FY24 so far in FY25. Based on the institutions where they're going, we do see that 53% are going to the private institutions, 38% to a Minnesota State institution, and 9% to students at the U of M. For fiscal year 24, the vast majority of students, almost 60%, were enrolled in a two-year program, and 24% were in a four-year program. And then we have 17% of students receiving MISP at a graduate level. Student Teacher Grant Program is actually two programs that we kind of umbrella into one called Student Teacher Grant. This is a funds that are for students who are doing their 12 weeks of student teaching. And the two programs, one is designated for shortage areas and the other is for underrepresented teachers. Both of the programs provide a one-time award of up to $7,500 during that semester where they're student teaching. In fiscal year 24, we had 131 students receiving it under the shortage area for about $850,000 worth of grants. And then for fiscal year 25, we had about 114 recipients with an awarded amount of about $735,000. For the other category, the underrepresented students, we had 280 students receiving it in fiscal year 24. About $1.7 million was awarded, and then in fiscal year 25, we had 203 recipients so far with $1.3 awarded. We are still dispersing those awards, so that amount will change.
Just a quick question for you. This is probably more just some follow-up. I know that we've been trying to address specific teacher shortage areas, and we've maybe even made some additions to certain professions we've added to the list. Would it be possible in the future to get something from OHE that shows if we've been seeing increases to students who are enrolling in those programs specific to those shortage areas as we have continued to try to entice more to enroll? That would just be helpful information for us to see if what we're doing is working or if we have to look at other things that we can do as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. We can certainly get that information. The next program I'd like to talk about is a pilot program, a temporary funded program, and that's the Minnesota Aspiring Teachers of Color Scholarship. This is for teachers or students who are preparing to become teachers, but they're not necessarily in that student teaching term. They have to have demonstrated financial need and belong to either a racial or ethnic group that's underrepresented in the state's teacher workforce. The annual award is up to $10,000, and the lifetime cap that a student can receive under the program is $25,000. This was originally intended to sunset in the 2024 year, and then we did receive a one-time $1 million investment to continue the program for an additional year for FY25. So this program will close at the end of this year. In FY24, we had 180 recipients awarded $1.4 million, and in the current FY25 year, we have 105 awarded so far, with $861 awarded.
So if I may interrupt you again, I would just ask a similar question in regard to these metrics as well. I know this program is fairly new, correct me if I'm wrong, but again, if we're trying to target more folks specifically, do the numbers demonstrate that we're finding success in doing that, or do we need to tweak or change our approach? Thank you.
The last program I'll talk about is another temporarily funded program. That's the Minnesota Paramedic Scholarship. This is for eligible Minnesotans. This fall was our first year with this program. And it's intended to help people completing a paramedic degree or diploma. We've received a one-time appropriation of $3 million for this program to provide up to 600 scholarships at $5,000 per scholarship. The program will end on June 30th, 2026, or when all funds have been expended. To date, we have awarded about half of the anticipated scholarships, or 298 scholarships. If there aren't any other questions about the financial aid programs, I'll pass it back over to my colleague, Dr. Wendy Robinson.
Any questions? All right, sounds good.
All right, now we're going to turn to talk to about some of our competitively funded grant programs that are administered by the Office of Higher Education. One of our newer programs is our Student Parent Support Initiative, which is a program that's designed to help support college students, post-secondary students who are parenting dependent children. And it's really designed to have a two-pronged approach to both ensure that children are getting the healthiest possible start and getting support as they are, you know, going through their developmental stages, and that their parents are getting holistic and wraparound support to help make sure that they're able to complete their college credential and then be able to enjoy the enhanced economic stability that comes from having earned a college degree. This program is administered in partnership with the Minnesota Department of Health. This year, we are able to complete our first round of grants for serving 13 organizations across the state. So this participation in this grant was open to both colleges and universities, as well as community partners who are working with this population of students. One of the things that's nice about the way that the awards happened with this program is it really does represent Minnesota's geographic diversity, as well as diversity within our higher education institutions. So we had a total of $5.3 million in funding awarded to 13 organizations that included schools like Central Lakes College, College of St. Scholastica, Metro State, St. Kate's University, Minneapolis Community and Technical College, as well as community organizations like the Jeremiah Program and the Raise the Bar Foundation. So we are obviously in the early stages with this program, but really looking forward to seeing that population of students get some additional support as they work toward meeting their educational goals.
Quick question for you. We talk about additional support. Is that primarily childcare, or what are some examples of things that folks are being receiving grants for?
Thank you for that question, Chair. So one of the things that was nice about the way that this program was configured is it really allowed the campuses and the community organizations to best identify what the needs were for their population of students that they're serving. And so looking at, there's a lot of flexibility for some of the programs or campuses. It was looking at childcare opportunities or how to help support students in either accessing campus supports for childcare or accessing childcare in their local community. For some, it was providing and building out campus resource centers that would help students connect with making sure that they were taking advantage of opportunities like WIC or SNAP or other supplemental means-tested benefits programs that they might be eligible for. For some of them, it was setting up things like priority registration or academic or social supports to help make sure that those students were connecting with campus resources. And so what the program looks like varies by campus to campus as they were kind of the experts on what their population most needed and what they felt like they were most equipped to be able to provide.
Thank you.
Another program that was newer since the last session was the Inclusive Higher Education Grants Program. And so this was established in 2023 to help college staff develop new or to enhance existing initiatives with the purpose of increasing enrollment and access for students who have intellectual or developmental disabilities, ultimately with the goal of helping them be able to be skilled to find employment and to pursue independent living if that's the best option for them following their completion of their program. The first round of grants were awarded in 2024. Lake Superior College received $200,000, to advance their work. We've also, in addition to this grant, continued to partner with the Institute on Community Integration at the University of Minnesota to establish the Inclusive Higher Education Technical Assistance Center. This center is designed on focusing on helping other institutions think about increasing access and support for self-sustaining inclusive post-secondary education opportunities within the state. Another competitive grant program that folks may be familiar with is our dual training grants program. And so our dual training grants provide grants to employers to support the related instruction and component of dual training programs. And so these are dollars that can be used to cover tuition, fees, required materials for related instruction in basically high demand occupation areas within our state. So they are awarded to employers in several different categories, including advanced manufacturing, agriculture, healthcare services, information technology, childcare, transportation, and the legal cannabis industry. For 2024, a total of $5.4 million was awarded to 84 employers to fund dual training programs for 958 employees in high-demand industries. The two industries that had the highest level of awards were the healthcare industry, which had 42 employers that were awarded through that, and our advanced manufacturing industry, which had 26 employers that were awarded through that program. No applications were received from employers in the legal cannabis industry in 2024, so we've not made awards in that area yet. Another competitive grant program that correlates with some of the ongoing work around student basic needs, it's been a hot topic for higher education in the last few years, is our Hunger Free Campus program. And so these are grants that are designed to help address food insecurity on campus, recognizing that college students may have intermittent or ongoing challenges accessing reliable and regular food that they need to be able to learn. And so we have a couple of different opportunities for these grants, including a sustaining designation, a pathways designation, or an equipment grant. In 2024, we awarded 24 institutions with grants totaling $447,000. And some of the locations that got grants this year include St. Cloud State, the University of Minnesota Twin Cities and Duluth campuses, Pine Tech, Augsburg. So it's a list that is, again, representative of both the metro area and greater Minnesota, some of our larger institutions and some of our smaller institutions. And again, the campuses get to work with their students and to determine what the best way to meet those food needs are for their students in a way that's ongoing and sustainable for their campus. Another competitive grant program that we could highlight is the Emergency Assistance for Post-Secondary, or our EAPS grant program. And these are competitive grants that are funded to our private, nonprofit, and tribal colleges that are designed to help students who are in an emergency situation who have a need that might interfere with their ability to persist to the end of the semester or interfere with their ability to complete their education.
Can I interrupt you for one second? Sorry. Senator Putnam's got a question for you.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to be fair, I'm the one who's interrupting. He's much more polite.
The record shall reflect that.
Dr. Robinson, I had a question about the Hunger Free Campus grants. My memory or our understanding was that we appropriated about $1 million to that grant program. And I see that we spent $447,000. Can you help us understand the distinction between those two numbers?
Thank you for the question. We will follow up with that. My belief is that the million was for 2 years, and so this represents 1 year of funding, not for the full. So they will do another round of funding for 2025. But we will double check to see if my assumption is accurate.
Thank you.
Just to finish up on the EAPS grant program, so these funds that are awarded through EAPS are often sometimes matched on campus by funds through their foundation or from other efforts as well. And so this is an ongoing effort to, again, help stabilize students who are having challenges meeting their basic needs. As of December 2024, we've had over 3,300 emergency grants have been issued to students at the Minnesota State campuses, totaling over $2.3 million. Over 850 emergency grants have been issued to students at the University of Minnesota campus, and then over 900,000 was competitively awarded to 10 private nonprofit colleges and tribal colleges. And so this work continues to be ongoing as institutions continue to have those basic needs questions and provide that level of support to their students.
I do have a follow-up on that for you.
Yes.
Could you give us some examples of what an emergency would be in terms of qualifying for one of these grants? And the other question would be, do these colleges or universities, institutions have the ability to simply reward these grants, or do they have to come to OHE and get approval, or is there some sort of a process that they have to go through with you all before the grants can be administered, or do they kind of have the ability to make that judgment call?
Yes, thank you, Chair Duckworth. So the types of emergencies, it can be kind of helpful to think about basic needs as falling into a couple of different buckets. So food insecurity could be a bucket, housing is a bucket, transportation, childcare, some of those are some of the kind of most frequently seen ones that we have. An example of an emergency would be, you know, I am a student who is attending a college that is not on a bus line, does not have a public transportation route available to me, and I need to make a $600 car repair or I'm not going to be able to come to school. And I may or may not, I don't have the $600 to be able to do that. Could I apply for emergency grant to get that repair done so I can continue my education? It could be I'm going to get evicted because I'm short on rent this month, and if I'm evicted, I'm not going to be able to continue my education. Each institution, each campus has their own process that they'll use to make those awards, so they don't have to confer with OHE to say, you know, hey, can we award so-and-so $1,000 to help them get their rent covered for this month. Each institution will have an application process and then an internal review process to make that award to the student. And as part of that internal process, the goal is that that will also be an opportunity for additional intervention so that they would get connected to, say, to somebody who could say, hey, you have this need. Do you know that you're eligible for WIC? Do you know that you're eligible for SNAP? Do you know that you might be eligible for some other program that might also provide some ongoing stability for you? Are you connected with the resources that are available on campus? Do you know that we have a food pantry? And so it's really designed to be both an intervention in the meeting the immediate need, but also a relationship building opportunity to help students get stabilized so that they can have some more financial stability to complete their education once that award has been made as well.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. Are the colleges, universities required to take any other information into consideration when awarding these grants? Specifically, obviously, we take into account a lot of information when we're determining whether or not we award financial aid to students. Is some of that similar thought process applied to these grants, or can any student apply for them and be awarded an emergency grant regardless of what they may have filled out or submitted in terms of the financial situations of themselves or their families?
Thank you, Chair Duckworth. So broadly speaking, when the schools have their application process, as part of that application review, they're going to be looking at a couple of different factors. So one of the first things that a school would check is, did the student apply for financial aid? Like, are they leaving money on the table? Can we get them to do their FAFSA so maybe they can access those resources if they're available to them? Generally, they'll also be asked to provide some documentation that shows evidence of the need that they have, so an estimate from the car repair place or their eviction, you know, notice of pending eviction or something like that as part of that process as well. Each school will have somebody who is well-equipped to be able to look at the student's documentation that they provide and sort of determine whether they meet the criteria for the emergency grant at their campus. It's not just anybody who puts their name in is going to necessarily get funded, but there is a review process that's going to look at documentation and also look at what other wraparound services a student might be able to use for themselves.
Very good. So not to make light of it, but running a little short on my beer fund is not an emergency grant-worthy type of a request is what I think I hear you saying.
Senator Duckworth, as somebody who previously in my past life was helped oversee these programs on a college campus, I can say that that was never one that we really would have funded.
Very good. Sorry to disappoint you, Senator Putnam. Sorry, another follow-up from Senator Fatte.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there any data around for students that do receive the emergency grants, how much more likely they are to stay in school after receiving versus not?
Thank you, Senator Fatte. That's a fabulous question that we will have a much better answer to in about 3 years. So one of the things that's actually really exciting, and I'm giving away a future slide here, is that this year OHE was selected as one of the seven states in the country to participate in a SHEO Basic Needs Academy that's designed to further enhance our ability to integrate basic needs with our SLED system and with our data systems to be able to track incidences of basic needs or supports around basic needs and how they'll progress through through higher education and then on to employment. And so that's something that is a project that we're really excited about getting started this year. And so, you know, I think we have some obviously the campuses have some ability to track, you know, how many students were awarded in a particular semester and kind of what categories their needs came into. I don't know that we have data yet that kind of can give us that at the statewide level, but we will eventually. All right, a few other competitive grant programs to just touch briefly on. The one is our spinal cord injury and TBI research grant, which funds research into new and innovative treatment and rehab efforts for functional improvement of people with spinal cord and traumatic brain injuries. We received 33 proposals for funding through this grant program in 2024. Following a competitive review process, the advisory council was awarded 19 projects totaling $3 million. And then another grant program that is, I know, near and dear to the hearts of many people in this room is the David Tomasoni ALS Research Grant. And this grant provides funding for research that leads to prevention, functional improvement, and curative efforts for people with ALS. In fiscal year 2024, OHI awarded $4.3 million through this program to 5 grantees. We also have the Intervention for College Attendance Program for formerly incarcerated students, known as ICAPS. This was also a program that was established in 2023, which is a grant available to institutions and community-based organizations, allowing them to strengthen support services for students who've been formerly incarcerated, with the goal of ensuring that these students are able to complete their education and then have the economic stability that comes with having completed a credential. And this includes strategies like mentorship, navigation support, career exploration and awareness, and then holistic reintegration services to aid formerly incarcerated students, including some who may have been participating in our college and the prisons programs as they exit the DOC and come into our higher education systems. This was a one-time grant that was awarded in fiscal year 2024, and so a total of $291,100 was awarded to 4 organizations that you can see listed there. And then finally, we have a few other competitive grant programs to note. We have the Early Childhood and Family Teacher Education Shortage Grants, which was another one-time program to provide funding to post-secondary institutions to address early childhood and family education teacher shortage. Institutions may use the funds for tuition relief and other support for eligible Minnesotans. There were three shortage grants awarded in 2024. We also have our ongoing concurrent enrollment grants, which is for the development of new concurrent enrollment courses and the expansion of existing concurrent enrollment programs. And we received 2 applications and awarded those 2 applications grants in 2024. Next, I'll transition to talking about some of our loan repayment programs. The first one being the Teacher Shortage Loan Repayment Program. And this program provides student loan repayment assistance to teachers providing classroom instruction in Minnesota. And so this is to encourage teachers, particularly those who belong in a category that's underrepresented in the state's teacher workforce, to stay in Minnesota, to teach in Minnesota, to teach in licensure shortage areas, or to teach in rural school districts. This program has a base budget of $200,000 per year. Demand for this program remains high. In fiscal year 2024, just over 1,300 eligible applications were received, but we were only able to award 472 of them due to the limitations of funds. And the average award was $997.25. A few of our other competitive grant programs include the John R. Justice Student Loan Repayment Program, which is a federal program that's administered by OHI that encourages lawyers to become and remain full-time public defenders and public criminal prosecutors. Recipients receive student loan repayments in exchange for agreeing to serve full-time as a public prosecutor or defender in Minnesota for an initial 3-year period. The Minnesota Agricultural Education Loan Repayment Program provides student loan repayment assistance to agricultural education teachers in grades 5 through 12 at a Minnesota school during the current year. Recipients must work in the state for 5 years. The Aviation Degree Loan Repayment Program is similar in that it also has a 5-year work window within staying in Minnesota and provides repayment assistance to pilots and aircraft technicians. And then the Minnesota Rural Veterinarian Loan Repayment Program provides student loan repayment assistance to eligible veterinarians serving in designated rural areas, and they also must work in the state for 5 years.
Thank you. Senator Rarick has a question for you.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. After having gone through all of that, how many different programs does the agency administer for financial assistance?
Just a couple.
Thanks, Senator Rarick. It's a moving target, right? As we have some temporary programs, for example, the paramedic scholarship and that aspiring teachers of color, and then the loan repayment programs, obviously. And so we have probably, I would say, about 22 to 25 right now, some of those being loan repayment programs, as well as our self-loan program.
Yeah, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that said, do you believe that we, I would say one of the penchants we seem to have is to continue to bring forward a program that we think is a good idea without considering how it could maybe be wrapped up in an existing one? Do you think there's a potential to look at some of these programs that are out there and consolidate them so we could address maybe one of the things Senator Duckworth brought up earlier that would give you flexibility to move funds around if you're seeing one area that's not using all of its funds, and then on the back end make it easier on the administration to be able to keep track of everything?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rarick, appreciate you raising that. For a number of different reasons. One, you know, I would certainly appreciate a conversation around additional flexibilities, potentially because, or primarily, I should say, because, you know, the pressures that that Ms. Flores was talking about around a lot of our state financial aid programs right now, those are things, you know, that we realize many times outside of the legislative session window, where we don't have an opportunity to come before the legislature and, you know, contemplate our changes. There are certain relief valves that we have outlined in statute and can't go beyond that without, you know, additional agency flexibilities. You know, we do have, as some of you may be aware, transfer authority within some programs, within some financial aid programs, but in an unprecedented year like this with, you know, off the charts enrollment growth, with applicants representing a student profile that may be needier than we've seen historically, there have been pressures on almost all of our financial aid programs. And so, you know, options to kind of transfer unused balances in between programs hasn't really been an option, to be completely honest. Everything's been really strained. Again, a good problem to have. You know, now we're before you to talk about some potential solutions. So I will just say I appreciate the conversation around additional flexibilities. You know, two, I would say, Senator Rarick, you know, to your question about kind of all of these programs, you know, some are temporary, some are, you know, frankly, potentially appropriate for other committees of different jurisdictions, so not necessarily higher ed. But I will say, although this is not a budget conversation right now in terms of, you know, the governor's budget, the governor has proposed some additional funds for agency administration. And, you know, I think what you raise is an important one, because all of these programs require a lot of work on the back end to oversee and administer and track the data and report the data. You know, a very small grant program, you know, is certainly important to the recipients of that program. But if we don't get the, you know, related necessary agency administration funds to be able to run that program effectively, it puts a lot of pressure on the agency as well. So I just highlight the need for, you know, attention to additional agency administrative funds to make sure that we're, you know, appropriating all of the, or that we're administering all these programs that have funds appropriated in an appropriate manner.
Any follow-up? Senator Putnam?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to sort of extend my friend Senator Rarick's comments, I too like the idea of some flexibility in your disposition of resources, but I also want to say that I appreciate how strategic many of them are. And so, for example, this Minnesota Rural Veterinarian Loan Repayment Program, I've talked to the vet school several times over the past couple of years, and they're telling me that they graduate with an average of $200,000 in debt, which makes it functionally impossible for them to practice in rural Minnesota. Can you tell me a little bit more about that specific program in terms of like how much of a loan repayment we're helping with? Is this a long-term program that's existed for a while and is going to continue to? But again, this is part of my larger appreciation of your work. to be as strategic as you are with many of these projects. And also, I guess the counter argument too, I'm glad that it's difficult for you to do all this work because it's our job to make you miserable.
Senator Putnam, I can answer that question. So for the Minnesota Agricultural Loan Repayment Program, the applicant, we received, generally we received 3 to 4 recipients per year. That's how much we have. It's 3 to 4 students benefiting from that program. And they're each awarded $15,000 in loan repayment assistance. And that's provided annually $3,000 per year over the 5-year service obligation.
I'm sorry, was that for the teacher program or the veterinarian program?
So for the teacher shortage.
Oh, the veterinarian was the one I was asking about. So
I'm sorry. I apologize, Senator Putnam. For the Minnesota Rural Vet Program, that is also where they signed a contract agreeing to serve 5 years in a designated rural area in Minnesota. And at least 50% of their service has to involve the care in food animals. The care of food animals, excuse me. Generally, we have 5 recipients per year. And each is awarded $75,000 in loan repayment assistance. That is provided annually in the amount of $15,000 per year over that 5-year service obligation.
Thank you for that, and thanks for doing it, too.
You're welcome.
Senator Mover Baton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was actually just wondering if you could go through for the programs on this page how many recipients you're receiving for each.
Thank you, Senator. So for the Minnesota Agricultural Education Loan, so that's the one that I misheard Senator Putnam ask about. Generally, there are 3 to 4 recipients each year, and each is awarded $15,000 in loan repayment assistance that's provided annually. So they receive $3,000 per year over the 5-year service obligation for the Agricultural Education Loan Repayment. For the Aviation Degree Loan Repayment, that also has a 5-year service obligation. One recipient per year is awarded $15,000 for aviation mechanics or $25,000 if they're a pilot in loan repayment assistance. And that is also provided annually over the 5-year service obligation in either the amount of $3,000 if they're an aviation mechanic or $5,000 if they're a pilot. And then that last one, the rural vet, were those numbers that I had provided for Senator Putnam, where we have generally 5 recipients per year, each receiving $75,000 paid out over the 5 years at $15,000 per year.
Any follow-up?
Please. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are there any income caps? Are you looking at things like, I don't know, any of the other sort of criteria that we may look at when deciding when to, what awards to amount to students? I'm just wondering if this is just open to anyone, if the criteria is just to provide that service, or if there's any other criteria that you're looking at, particularly around income.
Thank you, Senator Umar Baraden. The answer to that question is there isn't an income requirement for these programs, but they do have to demonstrate that they do indeed have student loan debt. So they send in documentation showing that they do have that debt, who holds that debt, what their monthly payments are.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any other questions? Okay, I think we're good to continue.
So, Mr. Chair, if it's possible, curious wanted to go back to Senator Putnam's question about the Hunger Free Campus grants and correct the record with
some
information.
If you dare, you can go ahead.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Go ahead, Nikki.
Hello, Chair Duckworth and committee. Obviously, I was trying to avoid coming up here, but for the record, my name is Nikki Oliver. I'm the Director of Government Relations and Community Engagement for the Office of Higher Education. And I know, Senator Putnam, you mentioned you all did appropriate $1 million a year for Hunger Free Campus, so you were correct. And while we issued out only $500,000, you also appropriated a one-time $500,000 for equipment. But also in the statutory language for the program, there were caps provided for this funding. So there were sustaining designation grants. that were capped at $15,000 per applicant, and then pathway to designations that were capped at $25,000 per applicant, and then the equipment grants that were capped at a maximum of $25,000 per applicant. And then we added in that private colleges could receive it, and there were also 50% match requirements. So while we funded, I think, about 25 campuses, because of those caps, that's why there was only funding about $500,000 that went out the door. So that's why there was that limited funding that went out last year for the programs. So some campuses received pathway grants, sustaining grants, or they received both sustaining and equipment grants, pathway and equipment grant funding. So combination. So just to clarify. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now I will leave the table.
Sounds good. We'll try not to get you back up here.
All right, Mr. Chair, we'll proceed. I might date myself here, but go, go, gadget arms. All right. So I want to talk just briefly to wrap here the next few slides on some of our ongoing initiatives, and I'll take the first one and then hand it over to Dr. Robinson. And just wanted to take the opportunity here to thank the legislature for your leadership in appropriating funds to allow the Office of Higher Education to fulfill this statutory mandate to hire a tribal relations director. We were fortunate to hire Raphael Eubanks earlier this year, and he has certainly hit the ground running. He's a citizen of the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe and has a lot of experience in the financial world, working on behalf of the federal government as well alongside tribal nations, not only within the state, but across the nation as well. And in fulfillment of the statutory requirement that we have a liaison, a tribal relations director, we're also able to consult on a government-to-government basis with tribal nations here in the state on particular areas of interest related to higher education. And so Raphael and I have been able to travel the state over the last few months and consult individually with nations, as well as work closely with the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council and the Tribal Nations Education Committee. And some really cool opportunities have popped up as a result. A few tribal education departments have actually organized their own college fairs and have partnered with area colleges and universities that some of their citizens attend, or students, high school students, are looking to attend. And so it's been a great opportunity in partnership thus far, although still pretty new. We look forward to kind of continued leadership here in this area, but just want to thank the legislature for that appropriation. We were one of the last agencies to be able to hire a liaison, and so he's also plugged in closely with that network of other state agency liaisons.
And now we'll turn to a few other of our ongoing initiatives. One of the ones that we also began with following the 2023 legislative session was convening a student basic needs working group. The topic of student basic needs and the role that meeting basic needs or having basic needs shortage plays in college completion has really been an ongoing conversation that's been happening at both the campus level, at the system levels, and at the state level as well. And so we convened a working group to review, assess, and make specific recommendations on strategies to how to further that work happening in the state of Minnesota. I had the good fortune of being the person in charge of convening that working group, and I will say it was the largest working group that I've ever convened, because we had such great representation from students, from faculty, from staff, from the systems, from community organizations, just really a vibrant and diverse group of folks who are really passionate about making sure that students have what they need to be able to be successful. We worked over the course of a year to put together a basic needs report that was submitted to the legislature in September 2024. If you've had the time or the good fortune to be able to read that report, you'll note that it identified both broad strategies around fiscal sustainability and stability for students, but then also strategies within those basic needs buckets that we've talked about. So what are some opportunities that the state could provide some support or resources or guidance related to housing, related to transportation, related to childcare, related to healthcare? The working group is really designed with the target of saying, let's really highlight the things that require state intervention. So not necessarily saying, what are the things that campuses can do on their own or campuses can continue to build and sustain, but where are opportunities where the state, either through funding or through legislation or regulation, would be able to help advance that work moving forward. Since that report has been submitted, the work has continued in a couple of different ways. Both there's really robust work happening within the systems and on each individual campus. But then at the OHE level, as I mentioned, we were selected as one of the 7 states to participate in the SHIO Basic Needs Academy that we're very excited about. We've recently completed a survey and a landscape analysis around trying to get a better picture of where we're at with food resources on our campuses to see which campuses are at the point where they have a standalone sustained food pantry model versus mobile food pantry versus got granola bars and we're doing the best that we can and to identify what are the levels of intervention that we might have to help build those out or what are some of the barriers that schools may be facing to try to enhance their food availability if that's a priority area for them. And we're also really committed to continuing the work of FAFSA completion and FAFSA outreach. We know that financial aid is really a cornerstone of financial stability for students, and so we really want to make sure that as we have those basic needs conversation, we don't lose sight of the fact that one of the things that is really essential for students is having that support with their tuition and fees. I also want to talk regarding our direct admissions program, which is one of my favorite programs to talk about and probably the one that I get asked to talk about the most from external sources. I think Aaron Salazak, who's our direct admissions coordinator, and I have probably now had conversations with, I think we're at almost 20 other states who've reached out to us to say, talk to us about direct admissions. How does it work? What are you doing? How did you set this model up? How is it so successful? And so those are some of the conversations that we really enjoy having. We are now in the 3rd year of that program, and that's the program that's designed to make sure that our graduating high school seniors know that there are college opportunities available to them, know that there are wonderful college opportunities available to them in the state of Minnesota, and to alleviate the anxiety of that will I get in question by saying these are the schools that have committed that they're going to say yes. Also, we're going to waive your application fee and we're going to make sure that we're getting connected so you have opportunity to choose for the institution that's the best fit for you. Students get to decide. They get a lot of autonomy in this process. So they get their direct admissions letter, ideally in the fall of their senior year of high school. Depending on their academic performance through their junior year of high school, they'll get a list of colleges and universities that have committed to saying yes if that's the school that the student chooses. At a minimum, the students will see 26 names on their letter. At a maximum, they'll see 55. One of the things that makes our direct admissions program unique around the country is that we have participation from both private and public institutions and 2 years and 4-year programs. And so that's one of the things that's, honestly, one of the things I'm really the most excited about with our program is that we do operate from that position that there's lots of great options at a variety of types of institutions for students. The program continues to work toward full-scale implementation. Since the beginning, the goal has always been that eventually all public high schools in Minnesota will participate in this program. We are also really open to having private and parochial schools participate as well, and also as charter schools are participating as well. In our first year, we had 46 high schools representing 28 counties. In year 2, we had 120 high schools representing 42 counties. And then this year, we have 182 high schools participating, representing 56 counties. And by sheer coincidence, I'll share the names of a few high schools that may coincidentally sound familiar to some people who are sitting across from me, just by sheer coincidence. Some of those direct admissions high schools include Wellstone International, Apollo Senior High School, Wadena Deer Creek, Staples Motley, Roseville Area, Hmong College Prep, Como Park, Cloquet, Mesabi East, Detroit Lakes. We have really been committed that we want to make sure that this is a program that's representing Minnesota's geographic diversity and diversity in terms of size of high schools and student population as well, and that's a target that we've been able to hit every year as we've continued to scale this program up. This year, this program will benefit up to 32,224 high school seniors, 45% of whom identify as students of color, 37% of whom are eligible for free and reduced lunch meals. So far this year, we've had over 7,200 students opt-in through the direct admissions program, sending out more than 47,000 requests for application to Minnesota institutions. This is a huge increase from the previous year. We have probably over 3,000 more students participating this year than we did last year, and that's comparing our numbers in progress right now to our end of the year numbers from last year. And so we're going to continue to see this program just increasing in size as we bring on more schools. We are, as I mentioned, scaling has always been part of the plan, and so next year we're already in the process of a recruitment for the next batch of schools to start and join the program for next year. One of our other programs that I think is making a difference in terms of college access and helping us meet our attainment goal is our federally funded Get Ready program. And this is a program that provides middle and high school students with programming designed to improve post-secondary outcomes, particularly for students from low-income backgrounds, indigenous communities, communities of color, and first-generation students. This is a program that is really, we have a variety of interventions around developing a sense of college aspiration, developing good study skills, academic skills, the resources and help necessary to do a college search, to access financial aid. It's really designed to be a holistic model with multiple interventions, beginning with our students in our cohorts, beginning in middle school all the way through high school. This is a federally funded program that operates on a 7-year grant cycle. Our grant cycle came up this year. And I'm going to brag about our team for just a minute. It was incredibly competitive to get refunded. And by incredibly competitive, I will say 12% of the programs that applied for this round of grant funding got accepted. You had to have a perfect score on your grant application to get renewed or to get accepted into the program again this year. And so we were one of 8 states in the country that had that perfect score and were able to be continued. And so that represents a huge opportunity for the state to continue the good work of this program, the proven success that we've had, and to expand out to some schools that hadn't previously been participating. And so we will reach over 6,000 students in our capacity building schools and then another 2,500 or more in our partner outreach schools. And then as we have students move through the program and get to their senior year and transition into higher education, we also, as part of this program, have some scholarship funds available to them as well as some supplemental coaching to help them make that transition from high school to college successfully. You've heard us mention our SLEDs or our data systems a few times, but one of the things that helps us do the work that we do and helps us be able to tell the story of what's happening within post-secondary education, what happens to our students after they graduate, is because we have a robust SLEDs and early childhood ECLDS system. And this is these data systems represent some really great collaboration between different government agencies as well. So it's highly collaborative. We have an ongoing partnership between OHE, MDE, DEED, DOC, MDH, the Department of Children and Families. So we're pulling together to data to get as comprehensive a picture as we possibly can about what's happening with students who interact with our post-secondary systems in the state. Some of the work that we use the SLED system to be able to help us do is to track things like our educational attainment goal, to get ready to produce our legislatively mandated Getting Prepared report, which tracks students from high school to higher education and developmental education. We use it for, indeed we use it for EOA reporting and for dual training. We'll look at, ECLDS looks at data collected by MDH, DHS, and MDH into looking at children's growth and achievement in relation to their participation in educational and social programs over time. And so we have a really robust data environment through the work of our SLEDs and our ECLDS system. And it's also worth noting that they also received a $4 million grant to do more work around alternative pathways to careers with family-sustaining wages. So kind of getting to that question of what are the employment outcomes for students who come through different educational pathways in our state, and kind of what does that mean for them over the long term of their economic life. And then finally, I want to note just a note about our self-loan program. This was a program that began in 1984, and it's an option for Minnesotans who are attending and participating Minnesota or out-of-state school, or non-residents who are attending and participating Minnesota schools. And this is a program that allows for students who have some who are looking for some additional resources to help cover their cost of tuition and fees, and this is a way to help them avoid having to take out private student loans if they maybe don't have enough yeah, they have some unmet need or need some additional financial resources. So the loan amounts are limited to cost of attendance minus other financial aid. And the students may accept up to $20,000 per year for bachelor's and graduate programs, $10,000 per year for programs of 1 to 3 years in length, and then $3,500 for programs that are less than 1 year. In fiscal year 24, self-loan had made 5,741 loans to the tune of $60.5 million. And so that's, an ongoing program that has been utilized by students who are, there's up to 405 schools that students may be able to take their self-loan to, both in Minnesota and outside of the state. And it does require students to complete a FAFSA and also requires the completion of some online counseling around taking on student loans, how to repay student loans at the back end, and also requires that they maintain satisfactory academic progress while they're enrolled.
Commissioner, anything else to add before I open it up to questions?
Mr. Chair, no, not at this time, other than I was looking for the next slide, but that will be Thursday, so this is our cut point.
Sounds good. Any questions? Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This was so comprehensive, thank you, but I wrote down a few questions and wanted to make sure you were able to get through the presentation. On the student parent support initiative, those are going to like institutions or community groups, and that's separate from the post-secondary child care grant. Do you look at if folks are, particularly for institutions, if they're helping people navigate that? And then I'm just curious how much is appropriated for that grant and if there's a lot of demand or if we're meeting that need.
Sorry, looking for my correct slide here. Thank you. Thank you, Senator Rubin, for that question. So we did have a total $5.3 million that was awarded in this round. And so that is almost the full appropriation for this cycle. In terms of the criteria, it was a competitive grant program, and so we did ask institutions to identify what they identified as the chief needs that were facing their students and sort of what their initial capacity was and what capacity they wanted to build out as part of that. Given that this grant program is still in its early stages, you know, we don't really have data to share about kind of the outcomes of the program yet, but that's certainly something that we will look forward to doing, reporting out as we have a better sense of how that program is being implemented and what the outcomes are looking at.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that answer. Also a huge fan of the direct admissions program, and I'm really glad to see schools in my district are participating. I'm always asking folks if they know about that program. But are you hearing anything from school districts that haven't decided to participate yet about why they're not, any barriers they're facing to participating in direct admissions?
Yes, thank you for that question, Senator Rubin. You know, as we... one of the things that we've done this year has been we've actually received some external funding through the Lumina Foundation to try to build out some more capacity for direct admissions. And so we've been doing a series of regional counselor convenings. So myself and Aaron Salzak, who's our direct admissions coordinator, have been taking our show on the road and have gone to a couple different parts of the state to try to connect with high school counselors, both from schools that are participating in direct admissions and from those who are not, to try to answer that, get a better handle on that question, and to sort of identify what are the barriers that they perceive or what are some of their challenges. I would say the information that we're hearing from those campuses is kind of a combination of factors. Some, you know, it's still just awareness that the program is still relatively new, and so maybe they haven't heard about it or kind of maybe had a little bit of a wait and see approach to see how it was going to be implemented. I think there are some high schools where they've had a fair number of transition in their high school counseling departments, especially post-COVID. And so if you have counselors who are kind of newer, they may still be in the position of like, it's my first year, I'm just learning my school, I'm learning my students, I don't want to take on a new initiative yet. And so we're constantly, you know, making sure that they're aware that this is not something that they have to go through alone, that part of our job is to provide support to them as they onboard. And then some of our institutions, it's getting their student information system up and ready to be able to do that and making sure that we're equipped to help them with some of their technology challenges that they may be facing or may be perceiving as a barrier for them. And so I think it's, you know, there's not... at this point, we have not turned down any school that wants to participate. And so we've really been trying to have as open a door as possible. And really, every year that we do the program, we're able to let them know, here are the outcomes, here's what we're seeing for the students, here's what the benefit is for you, and also to be able to address some of the concerns of, you know, here's what the actual work capacity is for your department, here's what you'd need to be able to do, here's how it kind of fits into some of your other initiatives as well.
Anybody else? All right, well, thank you all for being here. We greatly appreciate the information, all the time, work, and effort you put into preparing it. I know Thursday we're gonna dive more into the state grant, but for now, I think that covers most of the day. Senator Fattah, anything to add?
That's it.
Okay. He says we're adjourned.
Thank you.